Ralph Nader is an author, a lecturer, an attorney, and an American political activist in areas of consumer and worker protection, humanitarianism, environmentalism, and democratic government. He is also a regular listener to this program. So when he asked if he could be on to talk about his new book, Who Was I to Say No? Ralph Nader's latest is Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country That Works for the People. It is an exploration where Nader dissects the astonishing twists and turns that came to us following the 2020 presidential election. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ralph Nader to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much, Joe.
This is an interesting book because you talk about starting the revolution. I am interested in what you think the state of any revolution is in right now, because I guess the main question is, why do we need one?
Well, our democracy is deteriorating rapidly, and we're losing our control over government, which is dominated heavily now by corporations, money in politics, lobbyists, all kinds of things that you've interviewed authors for on your own program, Joe. And remember Thomas Jefferson, he said, we got to look at our government every 15 years and see how we can change it. And so the revolution I talk about is long overdue improvements, long overdue. Like the minimum wage federally is still $7.25, frozen since 2009. There are millions and millions of workers are making less than $15 an hour. Some states like New York have upped it, but a lot of majority states haven't. The other long overdue, Harry Truman in 1940s, universal health care for everybody, universal health insurance. We still don't have it. We have over 20 million people uninsured and another 40, 50, 60 million underinsured. And the rest go through all kinds of obstacles with inscrutable billing, delays of paying benefits, and so on. Cracking down on corporate crime, that's a no-brainer. That's law and order. You got huge left-right voters who want to crack down on Wall Street crimes, on the crimes like committed by the opiate manufacturers or the Boeing crashes. And you know, every day it's in the newspaper. Fraud, all kinds of price-fixing, abuses of children by Silicon Valley and Internet. Money in politics has never been worse and bigger. It's now overwhelmingly commercially based, PACs pumping all kinds of money into campaigns. So we start making a list of how you measure a democracy when it declines. What are the metrics? Or when it surges. And it usually surges when people reserve enough time to be active citizens, focusing on their local city council, state legislature, and Congress. It's not enough just to march and picket. A lot of that energy goes into the ether. You got to focus it on the institutions that can only make the decision. In our country, it's the legislatures. So this book is full of long overdue improvements and rights for people as a first stage. You always want to go with something that has very wide support. Like there's over 80% of the people want to restore and increase taxes on corporations. There are a lot of big corporations making profits in the U.S. and they don't pay any taxes, or they pay 3, 4, 5%, while a working person is making 20, 25% tax payments. Very unfair and unequal. You start with that, and that's what this book is all about. By the way, you know, I know you have quite a few elderly listeners, Joe. This is very easy to read. I'm sure you'll agree. It's got dark print and a lot of space between the lines.
and a lot between those lines, and a lot to think about along the way. I'm interested in who is responsible, I guess, of what, and we've talked about this before, but the responsibility of leadership and the responsibility of the citizens to take on these issues. And it obviously can be easier if you have a leader, but how do you, even in the starting of just working off the title of the book, of starting a revolution, is that something where this has to come from the level of the citizens and the people of this country?
It does, because the lawmakers are stuck with campaign money and other lobbyists that offer them all kinds of goodies and their children jobs when they grow up. And we know the drill. And I'll give you an example in just a minute. But in answer to your question, historically, almost every advance for justice in America has never taken more than 1% or less of active people focusing on their legislators, say, congressional districts. Less than 1%, even the civil rights movement. As long as they meet three criteria, that this 1% or less of American people know what they're talking about and they're accurate and they're straightforward. The second requirement is they reflect public opinion. And the third is they focus on the decisional arenas, namely the Congress, the legislature in Albany, and your city council. And you go through all the improvements in our country. Like in auto safety, we didn't even have a fraction of 1%. We had 1,000 people. We knew what we were talking about. The auto companies were not building safe cars. We focused entirely on Congress. And when I started, I didn't have one vote. And when the bill passed in September 1966 to regulate the auto industry in terms of safety, pollution, and other things, it was unanimous. Unanimous in the House and the Senate. So that's the power of people. Nixon, when he was in office, for heaven's sake, a right-wing Republican mired in corporate money, he supported a much better health insurance reform than Bill Clinton did. He supported a minimum wage increase. He supported what's called a basic livelihood wage for people. And Congress was bickering and didn't respond to him. Why did he do that? Because he feared the rumble from the people from the 60s and 70s. He had his finger to the wind. The last Republican president to be afraid of liberals, by the way. So here's an example of what I'm talking about. Right in New York. You know, New York State, New York City are heading for deficits, especially New York City. All right, well, every day, and you know this, every day the state of New York rebates about $40 million in a tiny sales tax on stock transactions in Wall Street. It's 0.1%. Not compare sales tax people pay 7% or whatever in New York when they go into a store and buy necessities of life. Now, the majority of the Assembly and the Senate support stopping the rebate and keeping the money. It amounts to maybe as high as $15 billion, that's with a B, a year. That's real money, according to Assemblyman Phil Steck and State Senator Sanders. And there's a bill before the Albany legislature. It's got majority support, but not the head support. They don't quite reach yet the Speaker and the President of the Senate, who have, as you know so well, decisive power. But it's coming. A poll shows overwhelming support by the people of New York, and the bill allocates that money to mass transit, health care, education, and deforestation. So it's very, very targeted, $15 billion or so dollars. So one thing is the people don't know much about it because the media is not talking about it. WAMC has had Blair Horner on. NYPERG has a coalition in favor of it. But look at the New York Times. Look at the other major papers, the TV. They're ignoring it. And here it is, ready money. I mean, where else can you say you're already collecting it, for heaven's sake? What are you giving it back to the brokers for? So there's an example where less than 1% of New Yorkers can get it done. People give up on themselves, Joe. They create overwhelming visions of opposition. It ain't going to happen. It can't happen. The big boys run the show. Well, last time I read the Constitution, there's no reference to corporation company in the Constitution. It only refers to we, the people, and persons. So let's get some motivation here, folks. You can go to corporatecampaign.org, and the famous corporate campaign reformer, Ray Rogers, who lives in New York City, will send you material, and you can get all kinds of information on what you can do right on that website free. See, there's an example for you. The lawmakers will follow the people once the people make their wants specifically known and with stamina and telling them that they're not going to go away.
Ralph Nader is our guest. The name of the new book is Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country That Works for the People. You are very critical of the Democratic Party in this book. You are critical of both major political parties in this book. But you do look at the Democratic parties, and there's just one part of this I would like to focus on, which is you talk about their alarming aversion to introspection. And that just got me wondering that over the last 2.5 months, do you think in the choosing of a different candidate and looking at the possibilities that maybe not in the way that you are thinking, but in a way that the party became more introspective?
Well, they faced reality that Joe Biden was likely to lose to Trump, the worst presidential candidate in memory. You know, if you can't beat someone who's a chronic liar, a fantasist, a self-enricher, a serial federal law violator, a convicted felon under indictment in three other cases, and cannot begin to even debate. He doesn't debate. He just ignores the questions by the reporters and says what he's been saying on the rallies day after day. So they faced reality. Unfortunately, it wasn't a competitive process to see who's going to replace Biden at the convention. And they coronated Kamala Harris. And what do we see here? We see almost exactly the same policies, whether it's in the Middle East or Ukraine or domestically, that Biden has. She hardly diverts from them. And the CNN interview demonstrated that very recently. So in this book, I say the Democratic Party is a scapegoater. Every time it loses to the worst Republican Party in history, at whatever level, it blames someone else, usually the Green Party. They blame Jill Stein, for example, a tiny, tiny vote. When they have, nationally, they have about 100 million voters who aren't going to vote. Why don't they work that one more vigorously? Well, here's what they've done to themselves. They've diminished themselves. First, they write off half the country, red state. They're not even competitive in half the country. Howard Dean warned them about this. So how can it be a national party and you write off half the country? In Wyoming, there are 32 counties, and there are two counties with the Democratic Committee. I mean, there's some places that they don't even exist. And so that's one. The second, they've lost the gerrymandering race. They both do it, but the Republicans do it better. In effect, carving out districts so the politicians pick the voters, not the voters pick the politicians. And third, they don't purge their own ranks. You have corporate Democrats who take huge money from corporate PACs. They protect Trump's tax cuts. They do what the corporations want done. Richard Neal in Western Massachusetts is very much like that. And they don't call him out. Mark Ian Warren and others should say, you know, Richie Neal, you were head of the House Ways and Means Committee, and you never had hearings on the collapse of the corporate tax system, even though your subcommittee chair, Representative Lloyd Doggett from Texas, was very eager to have hearings. What's up? John Larson wants to increase Social Security benefits frozen for 40 years. How come Nancy Pelosi kept it from going to the floor? It's tremendously popular in the polls. You think conservative elderly people don't want an adequate Social Security benefit with higher taxes, Social Security taxes on the wealthy to pay for it, among other reforms? So corporate crime, they've jumped ship on that. That's an easy one. You pull cracking down on corporate crooks, you get close to 85-90%. That's a lot of conservative and liberal voters, and they jumped ship on that. They've abandoned Bernie Sanders' single payer, universal health care. Everybody in, nobody out, more efficient, and less harassing with all these inscrutable medical bills you can't figure out and not get your calls returned. So all these things are described. And when you have corporate Democrats controlling the process with corporate conflicted political consultants, Joel, and that's who are the gatekeepers. It's very hard for people like us or progressive Democrats to get through to the campaign to say, look, I have this strategy. I have this way to get votes out. I have this idea that would get good press. Why aren't you doing it? You can't get through. I remember once, you'll like this story, Joe. I called up Liz Moynihan. Yeah. She was the spouse of Senator Pat Moynihan, who I've known for years. And I said, how are things, Liz? And she says, great, I just fired my consultants. I said, what? She says, yeah, I just fired them. I'm taking over the campaign management for Pat. Of course, he won easily. And then before we finished the conversation, she said, I got to tell you one more thing, Ralph. I said, what? She said, these corporate consultants are destroying the Democratic Party. And try and get the New York Times, all the reporters that are covering the campaign, to do an expose of these corporate consultants. The last one I read about was by The Intercept in 2021, if anybody is interested. So you have all these hugely supported in the polls issues that they're not running with because they're dialing for the same corporate dollars as the Republicans. And they come with strings attached. So this book is a straightforward advisory, not just to Democratic candidates, to any candidates, Green Party, Libertarian, who want to stand for the people and who want to go with documented, proven improvements in our country that are supported by 70-80% or more in the polls. That's an unbeatable coalition out there that you can tap into.
The name of the book is Let's Start the Revolution by Ralph Nader. Before I let you go, sir, I would like to talk to you about just your thoughts on a mutual friend and someone who is very important in my life and I know is very important in your life, and that is Phil Donahue, the talk show host who passed away on August 18th at the age of 88. You have written some beautiful pieces about him over the last several days. In one, you say, I've called Phil Donahue the greatest defender and enabler of the First Amendment's protection of free speech, petition, and assembly in the 20th century, hands down. Could you talk a little bit about what we have lost with the passing of Phil Donahue?
We've lost a powerful voice for democracy and justice. People can read my full column. Go to Nader.org. You can also get it free automatically every week. But I wrote a column on Phil. Phil has been often described as an entertainer. You know, he's had male strippers on and, you know, to keep a large audience. But out of the 6,000 shows that he had, Joe, as you know, he had hundreds of shows where he gave voice for the first time to the women's rights movement, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, the consumer movement, the environmentalists, the peace advocates, people who could never get on media and who became leaders because he introduced them to 10 million voters. And let me put it this way, Joe. The country would be a lot better if we still had a Phil Donahue show. He was courageous, and he said the business of the press, and he wasn't just talking about talk show hosts, is not to pander. It's not their privilege to pander. They have to call out injustice. They have to give voice to the voiceless. And I'll tell you, if Phil was doing his program today, people like Reverend William Barber, the closest person we have in the country today to Martin Luther King, who just came out with a book called white poverty, saying the white poor are in the tens of millions. That it's class, not just race, that's keeping him mired that way. He can't even get on widespread TV or get reviewed. He would have been on Phil Donahue in a minute for an hour,
right,
reaching 10 million people. The minimum wage now would be a front burner issue because he would have had people on from labor, but he would have also had poor workers, and he would say, what would it mean for you to get more money? And they would elaborate the dire necessities of life that they could put on the table if they had a living wage. And the same thing with health insurance. It was a terrible loss in 1996 when he closed his show, and he then went on MSNBC in 2002, and because he wanted to give voice to people critical of the looming criminal war in Iraq by Bush and Cheney, like General Electric, who owned NBC and MSNBC, canceled them. They told him, you got 4 days, clear out your desk. He was the highest rated show on MSNBC at the time. So there needs to be a biography. We've got a good biographer who's written over 50 books. He knows how to produce. He's going to write a biography. No one comes close to being a greater defender, practitioner, and enabler of the First Amendment right to speak, assemble, and petition your government than Phil Donahue in the 20th century. Hands down, nobody close.
You know, I was struck by something that you wrote, too, and we'll close with this, but what you were just saying is so true. But the power, so much of that show was putting the microphone in the hands of the people, putting the microphone in the hands of people to ask questions about these very important issues, which simply doesn't happen anymore.
That's right. I mean, because it was live, he even took calls from a live audience. It could talk to 10 million people. And he took calls, as we know, from the audience. He'd bounce from one row to another with his famous microphone and give them voice. He learned how to do that because he found out that the people in the audience sometimes had better questions than he had of his guests on the stage. I was on 31 or 32 times, and I can tell you that a lot of people are alive today and not injured today and not fleeced and ripped off today because of the forces he put in motion by having people on who were advocates for justice in the country. He turned them into civic celebrities. You do some of this regularly, Joe. You shouldn't be too modest. You give voice to people who have written books or articles and, you know, haven't gotten on or into the New York Times or on national radio, NPR. By the way, you'll be interested. We're coming out with a nice report on NPR and how it can become much better. As you remember, they were over an hour delayed in reporting to your affiliate and others the January 6th insurrection. You remember that one?
Oh, yes, yes. We were there, yeah. And that came on the heels of 9/11, which we were also late at, which they said that would never happen again. So, yes, well, we look forward to seeing that. That'll be very nice to see. Well, I thank you very much, especially for talking about Phil. He was very special, and I know that you two are very close, and I'm thrilled that I got to talk to you about him. The name of the new book is Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country That Works for the People. Ralph Nader, I always love having you on. Thank you very much for being with us.
And thank your audience. My last comment is breaking through power, folks. It's easier than we think. We have American history to prove it. And don't give up on yourself. You're the power under our Constitution.
Thanks, Ralph. Always good to talk to you. Be well.
Yeah, thank you, Joe.
Take
care.
Be
in touch.
Again, the name of the book is Let's Start the Revolution by Ralph Nader. It is published by Skyhorse. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.